This is Expat Experts.
Welcome to this episode of Expat Experts, from my favorite spot of coffee here in the center of Athens, called Banca Cafe in Exarchia. Today we were talking about living abroad, even a stand-up comedian that defines, do you find yourself as a brash American I saw around?
Did I say that?
Yeah,
I wondered, did I say I'm a brash American? I mean, I am. Did I say it?
But currently you're touring around Europe.
Yes.
You won a BBC Popcorn Writing Award.
I was nominated. Ah. One of 20 people nominated.
Wow, okay, nice.
Yeah.
You are now doing a second show already,
yeah,
but it was with Involuntary Manslaughter.
That's correct.
Previous show that you were having. Mm-hmm. So yeah, actually, it was kind of funny because you contacted me because you are actually having a show this weekend here in Athens.
That's correct.
Which I don't know if this, whenever this episode, probably it will already be
gone,
but yeah, you're touring around Europe, so I don't only have listeners from Athens, I have listeners from everywhere. So
too right. I'll be in Barcelona soon as
oh,
well.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. So yeah, right. All the people from Barcelona, that's a clear check the date. but yeah, Abigail Paul, thank you so much for accepting the invitation, or like for getting in contact and reconnecting after, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 years.
So this is really weird because I contacted you and then you said, oh, I know you. We did stand-up comedy together and I didn't recognize you from your name because I just didn't expect to contact someone in Athens and be like, we're pals already.
Yeah.
But here, that's what happened.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, like we did stand-up comedy together.
We did, yeah.
Not stand-up in a sense of complete shows, but some open mics actually organized by Eva.
Yeah, exactly. Who I organize shows with now in Frankfurt.
Cool. Back in the day, we were doing it in the Hessenic, actually.
Like, we were, yes.
It was a tough audience, let's say, like this.
Yeah, it was a tough audience, yeah.
But, yeah. So it has been really funny that it was like the reconnection of like saying, okay, old people who know each other.
Here's my Spanish pal that I met in Frankfurt, Germany, and now I'm going to Athens and we're going to do a podcast together there. I think that's pretty fun.
Yeah.
I think that speaks to the expat experience.
Exactly. Hopefully, yes. So, yeah, just before we start with the first part of the episode, just remind to everyone who is listening to follow our social media accounts, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, I don't know, Fotolog and MySpace and all of these that we don't even have anymore. I suppose I'm there yet still. But yeah, of course, the most important part is following Spotify and YouTube, which is where I post the contents and the videos. And at the end, it's where it's more important that I have a little bit of like people. If you want to listen to the new episodes, it's where you can need to be stay tuned for knowing about them. But yeah, let's definitely dig into it.
Yeah.
The Expat, Episode 2 with Abigail Paul.
So just to put the audience, as we said, like, we met like 2 or 3 years ago when I was still living in Frankfurt, probably pre-COVID times or...
I feel like it was in this like medium COVID times. It was like after the big, we did some before and then the big wave came and then things opened up a little bit. So it was like a little bit before and then a little bit in the medium space of where you were allowed to go places but wear masks and stay distance and doors had to be open and windows had to be open. So it was like restricted and weird.
And this thing of putting a condom into the mics.
Yeah, we had a lot of mic condoms. Yeah, and we would spray down the microphone like that was going to do anything.
And promise to all the audience that we will not make corona jokes back in the day.
We really wanted to tell jokes.
But we did all the time. So yeah, like, actually you are originally from United States.
Correct.
From Florida.
That's correct. I'm from Florida, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you've lived quite some time already outside of the United States.
Yeah, right? I've lived in Frankfurt for 22 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, 22 years.
Yeah. Okay, that's a lot. Always in Frankfurt?
Always in Frankfurt, yeah. People are like, why? Yeah.
What brought you there? Yeah.
Okay, so I always say, like, I just came for fun, which is true. I thought Frankfurt would be fun, and it is. Human rights are super fun, in my opinion. But why specifically Frankfurt? I did have like a contact friend there who had been living in Frankfurt with her boyfriend. And so I kind of knew somebody. And then that helped me to be like, see it as a destination I might go.
I see. But it was really like a decision of I want to live somewhere else outside of the United States. Or listen, you had a job or like...
No, I had gotten the memo early that America was going down the tube. You know, that Gore v. Bush election, that was enough for me. I was like, this feels a lot like a car crash just about to happen. But I didn't intend to come forever. You know, I was just going to come for a year, check out, you know, living abroad. And then I think I just got really used to human rights very quickly. I enjoyed health insurance and paid time off from work and things that other people get to have all the time. I was like, I would like to keep these things. And so I could never find a good enough reason to go back.
Okay, crazy. Like, I mean, makes sense in a lot of you are saying the conditions of living probably in Germany, especially in Germany, probably are like compared to United States in terms of insurances. I don't know if you are not a super rich person and this kind
correct
of things.
Yeah,
it's probably easier life in Germany than in United States in that sense.
Definitely.
But at the same time, family-wise and everything, like you were leaving everyone behind
So remember that I was nominated for a prize by the BBC for a show called Involuntary Manslaughter.
Yeah
So I mean, the family thing was for me not a big problem. Draw right. I was pretty comfortable being 4,400 miles away from my family, and I made a lot of great friends right away. So I've been in the city for a really long time, and when you live the expat lifestyle, I'm sure you can speak to this. Like, it is very transient. Friends come and go. So it can be really tough to find, like, people that are kind of permanent. But even friends who've, like, moved away, they often come back. Or, you know, you do eventually get, like, what feels like family. So you kind of just get to rebuild your own family. And I kind of prefer that method.
No, it makes a lot of sense at the end. Like, and actually in Frankfurt, it happens that, but still like easier. Like, I don't know if you speak German back in the day that you came.
Not a word. I think I learned "Rufen Sie bitte die Krankenwagen an," which just means call the ambulance. So I wanted to have one key phrase sorted.
Just in case. Actually, it's a good one,
right? And then the rest was, as they say here, Greek to me. I didn't speak any German, but I learned it eventually over time in fits and starts. It's not an easy language, but I did it.
Everything but administration works, which is still a very complex thing for everyone who is not native German.
Even Germans don't like it, no, to be fair. It's really not a great language for writing
terminology that nobody fucking understands.
It's correct. It's like, I think that it's kind of rude of English to be a global language sometimes, but I'm also pretty pleased because it's super simple compared to other languages, let's face it.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Totally agree. So I already said you really never considered going back to the US then. Like, it was never in your mind, like,
no, that's not fair. I remember my first 5 years thinking I was definitely going to go back to the US and felt like just a matter of time. But then, like, I don't know, that feeling of having grown more comfortable in my new country and not really knowing how I could go. Like, once you have nicer things, it's very hard to have them taken away from you. And for me, the sense of comfort, I know it's like, you know, people say a lot of jokes about it, but the sense of comfort of knowing that if I had been sick, I could go to a hospital and no one would kick me out. You don't know what that's like unless you're American, where you never have a sense of security. I didn't have health insurance of any kind until I moved to Germany. Never. Even as a child, my mom just winged it. So, you know, I think I really enjoyed that stability. And yeah, I didn't want to give it up. So there are many things that you could be like, well, there's some better stuff in America, but go visit America if you like that stuff. You know what I mean? Like, it's available to you to live there, to retire there, to spend my life in worry of bankruptcy for medical things? No, I didn't think that was that fun. Yeah.
And you ended in Frankfurt, like the most international city in Germany, by the fact that you had friends over there already, which is, it's always a help when you start in a new place.
They left about a year after I got there, but that was still a good, like, it was like seed, friend seed.
That also sounds like Frankfurt, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It is Frankfurt, yeah. And then I made new friends, and then they all left. And then I had to make new friends. And
they all left.
That pattern really, I had nobody in my mobile phone to call for a few periods of my Frankfurt life. I won't deny it.
And over that time, you have friends everywhere, but in Frankfurt, that happens a lot. Yeah.
I just would go to an Irish pub and be like, hi, I'll be your friend tonight. That's what I would do.
Yeah, that's how you do it in Frankfurt.
Yeah, there's, as you said, it's a very international city. One third of the city is non-German. So 66% Germans, the rest of us, something else, you know? And that way we connect to each other, and it's not just Americans and Britons, it's people who just aren't German and like to speak some English or get to make new friends.
Was it like this like 22 years ago? Or it has increased like...
It's hard to say. I mean, I noticed a massive difference in like Berlin, for example, because when I moved to Germany, I first made a couple trips to Berlin, and you know, you had to speak German there, and like it was probably international, I guess, but you didn't notice it so much. And now Berlin is so international. It's like you can't get people to speak German to you. Yeah. Everyone speaks English. So it's really different. But Frankfurt always had, because of the banks, every single bank had at least one family or, you know, group of people in the city. So you always have had this multiple countries, food cultures, you know, running around.
And when you compare cities, and it's something that we discussed a couple of times with my girlfriend, actually, which is, she's from Frankfurt. I think there is a something in Frankfurt that they made pretty well, which is not doing this segregation in neighborhoods.
Yeah.
When you live in Frankfurt, if you don't live in the very, very, very expensive parts of Frankfurt, really posh, next level thing, and even with there, like, normally your neighbors are a bunch of different nationalities, like, and it's like there is no neighbor for, like, let's say for one culture and one neighbor for another. And that
there's some laws about that in Germany, I forget what they are, but they really went out of their way to make sure you wouldn't have any kind of ghettoization of any group or culture. In Vienna they do it as well. It's like a tactic. It's not by chance. People really don't want groups of people to not kind of be diverse and merge together.
And it works.
It does work, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, like, you arrive to Frankfurt and you never said, okay, I would like to move somewhere else in Europe, for example?
Yeah, well, there was an opportunity, as I said, I've been to Berlin a few times, and my husband and I almost could have moved there. And in fact, he moved there for a year and we kind of tried it out, but it's not our town. Frankfurt is very small. Like, Athens is gorgeous, but it's very, very big. And I don't function that well in places that are very big. So I ride my bicycle everywhere. If I have to take a train, it's 10 minutes. Like, things are pretty convenient and close.
Yes.
And green, I have to say. It's very parky. The air is pretty clean, especially for a big city. So, yeah, there's a lot of, again, just really basic quality of life things that maybe tourists wouldn't be like, oh, look at Frankfurt. But if you live there and it's your city, it's great.
I agree.
Yeah.
It's one of the things that definitely we miss here. Like, there's no parks in the city. It's a mass of concrete, Athens.
It's a lot of concrete. Yeah, I noticed.
It's gray as fuck.
It's pretty gray, yeah. Yeah.
And no parks. Well, there is the Botanical Garden here in the center.
Okay.
It is the national park thing next to Syntagma, next to the parliament. And in the center, I mean, even the Acropolis Hill, it's not green. It's stone, therefore it's not...
Yeah, everything is gorgeous. Like, there's a lot of marble everywhere. But then it's like, there's a lot of stone and marble and gray. And yeah, I wonder how people... I'm here in, it's March, but in summer, that would be pretty tough.
I mean, it's like something in between. And Frankfurt, it's not one of the most harsh temperatures in Germany, that's for sure. But at the same time, you're giving away like the fact of having 2 months here of extreme heat.
Yes.
For not having a 6 months of not seeing the sun in Frankfurt.
Yeah, you don't see the sun in Frankfurt, which is fine with me because I got all sunned out by the time. Yeah, we come from Florida. I'm good on sun. Like, I racked it all up. I banked it and I'm good for life. So,
I think for me, winters in Frankfurt, the most difficult part was definitely like the fact of not seeing the sun. Not even the temperature or whatever,
because
at the end, as German says, if you have good clothes, you can survive any kind of winter, no? Let's say like this, but... Oof, not seeing the sun from a person from Barcelona.
I know that really bothers people, but for some reason I've just never had that gene where I give a shit if there's sun. I just don't care. And in fact, I just think like it's going to give me skin cancer and I'd prefer to avoid it. And I wear hats and sunscreen. So I'm not a like sun person. I do notice when it's sunny. I do notice and it makes me happy, of course. I'm not like a crazy person, but I don't. Something about it doesn't intrinsically move me or not. I'm just like, I go about my day. Oh, it's great. Fine. You know, I just don't notice it that much.
It's not in your first points on the
Exactly. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Cool. So works for me.
Nice. Do you miss anything from America, like that you would like to bring to Frankfurt, actually?
These I would bring to Frankfurt. I mean, there's, when I go back and I visit America, you know, there's ease of being in your own language and your own culture that you never leave as an expat. Like, there's just something, like, even every once in a while I'll hear someone speaking American English and I'll pick it up. And you just, like, you tune in to your own thing. So it doesn't matter how many years you live abroad, you'll still always be what you were raised to be in the culture you come from. The things I miss are not good for me, so it's great that it didn't work out. Like, I would bring waffles and fried chicken. I would bring the worst stuff from America to enjoy it, but it's not good for me, so it's probably better that
to live it there.
To live in Frankfurt, where I cannot get access to incredibly bad food. That's what I miss from America, the junk food.
Ooh. Cool. You said, like, you went 22 years, you lived in Frankfurt for 22 years. Like, it was always like, as a stand-up comedian, you were always pursuing this dream, or like?
No. So I came really, like, very much like thinking I would leave after a year. Yeah. And then that kind of switched to like 2 years, 3 years, 5 years pretty quick. And then at some point, you know, I studied theater. So I'm a performance major, and I love to be on stage. And there's no other way to say it. It's just like, I do really love that. And I kind of grew up in the stage and in the theater. And a friend of mine who was doing some amateur theater was like, oh, why don't you come do this with us? And I was like, no, that's okay. And then I was like, you know, I kind of got my arm twisted. And then I started doing some theater stuff. And then I wound up meeting a professional theater person from New York. We hadn't known each other. She's also American. And we kind of vibed. And we both really liked the same kind of theater. We like to keep it really simple but meaningful. So we said, like, three women and three chairs. That's all you need. We don't love all the lights and the costumes and the flourish, you know. And so we started working together, and then we wound up doing our own theater company in Frankfurt. So I did that for 10 years. I ran a theater company in Frankfurt.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How did they know?
Yeah. Called Theater Language Studio Frankfurt, which is a very poncy name upon reflection and does not work well for SEO. So I'm really glad I learned that lesson.
I just changed the name of the podcast because of SEO reasons. So.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah. SEO is so important, folks. So we love the work, and we wound up eventually kind of almost shifting, not entirely, but shifting a lot from theatrical productions to improv. And the reason for that is because, well, first of all, it's fun. It's a really lot of fun. It's a great art form. And had quite a lot of training in it. And Renee and I both got a lot of training in it further when we started, like, really gaining a solid interest in it. And there was just something really lovely about teaching it. So we taught for 10 years as well. We taught a lot of classes and workshops. And, you know, there's something really beautiful about improvisation, because it really just depends on listening and agreement. And that's all you have to do to make it beautiful. And so we did that. And it was like I was saying, like, we'd have a class and be like, our class were like a little United Nations group, you know, someone from Sri Lanka, someone from Frankfurt, someone from Greece, like Italy, like France. Everyone just didn't necessarily fit into Frankfurt yet. And they'd come take our improv classes, and they would have this incredible strong connectivity in this activity. And so most of our students were like not trying to be performers, but they were just like, you know, worked in IT or banks or whatever. But they love.
We need to escape.
they needed an escape from a creative. And something that, you know, is really important to me as a creative person is that creativity doesn't belong to creative people. I think too many people think that creativity is like what artists do, like as in painting artists or even performing artists. But, like, I think everyone needs to keep creativity and art in their lives. So, you know, we did that as, like, again, a nonprofit. And then the pandemic came, and that was really tough. And I had already transitioned to about a year before the pandemic starting with stand-up comedy. Okay. And when the pandemic came, it just was like, you know, I wanted to pursue stand-up comedy. I had wanted to many times, but I knew how selfish and, like, hard it was. Like, selfish in the sense that you can't give your time to anyone else. If you're going to do this, you really have to just drill down on it and, like, write jokes, and it's discipline and writing and memorizing. And that had never been like my skill set, but I was like, I've always wanted to do it. I'm going to try it. And then, like I said, it was kind of a perfect storm. The pandemic came, and it was a much better time to be pursuing solo things than group things, ensemble things, where we could all infect each other. So I basically transitioned out of improv and theater into stand-up. But I'm doing a little improv again, just, you know, to keep it alive, because I love it.
I went the other way around, I suppose. Like,
oh yeah, because you're now doing improv.
I'm
now
doing improv. I have improv this afternoon.
Excellent.
Which is, I mean, I always like improv. I never did it regularly. Like, I always did one workshop here, one workshop there.
Yeah.
You know, in a little bit more, like, thingy. And at the end, I come from the more traditional theater scene. moved to musical stuff.
Ah, okay.
Then ended doing stand-up comedy because I always wanted to try it and whatever, realizing that it's not my thing at all.
I see. Okay.
I mean, it's not that I'm not good. It's just
I thought you were good. I remember that. I remember thinking, that guy's pretty good. So
yeah, but it's the amount of work
that it has been a lot of work
to put inside of it that kicks me out because it's, I mean, one thing is talking like in a podcast, no? And
sure.
When it's like a conversation that it can fluently go and things, nothing is incorrect and you don't need to have a punchline every two blocks or whatever.
Right.
I stressed the fuck out to write the whole like monologues and everything. And I was like, okay. And when I tried improv, I was like, okay, this is where you just say the things that comes to your head. And
yeah,
if they are funny, it's okay. If not, next thing. And that's all, you know, like,
yeah.
And I loved it. Like,
you have to have a strong sense of what is funny, I think, to be a successful improviser. Because I've met people who don't, and that does not work. But you can't try to be funny. And that's this beautiful place in improv where you're really just trying to co-create, listen, and build, and make something happen, and recognize, we found the funny thing. Let's get on this path together. I mean, that's so beautiful. But with stand-up, it's a question of, like, it's technical writing. It's putting one thing before the other. It's making sure there's a surprise. It's not actually fun to sit down and do the work, whereas improv rehearsals and classes are always such a blast. Sitting down at your computer to do fucking work on stand-up is not fun at all.
Not at all.
So all the reward comes in the 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes you're on stage when you did
if,
it.
If you have 10 minutes, who has 10 minutes
of
stand-up right now?
I think like...
Right now, the common thing in open mics is having 3 to 5 minutes.
3 to 5 minutes? Well, yeah, that's in like New York and Frankfurt, you know. We give people 7 to 8. And then it's not that hard to get 10
or 15.
Not here. Virklish.
Yeah, before we dig more into comedy and like stand-up and all this, because we can talk about that probably for quite some time.
We can annoy people a lot.
That's okay. That's why they are looking, no? If they are watching. Just a this or that questions, like...
Sure.
In the sense of, like, if you need to choose one or the other, what you'd be before we close the expat part, let's say, like this?
Perfect.
Let's go for a tricky one. American or German food? But you already said that, actually. American
food because I want to taste it. German food so that I can live.
That's a good response.
Yeah.
Same happened already with the second one. American or European lifestyle, in the sense.
European lifestyle so that I can live.
It's everything about living, eh?
Yeah.
And I think the next one, it's also about living, probably. Cooking with olive oil or butter?
Okay, for flavor, butter. For living, olive oil.
Yeah. And the last but not least, old people, like retired people in Florida or in Germany?
Okay, so this is complicated because I'm quite an old people expert. I grew up with a lot of grandmothers, a lot of surrogate grandmothers. In Florida, it's, you know,
It's the retirement place.
It's a retirement place, yeah. So my home was a retirement community, and I had a lot of, but like they weren't always the nice old people because they're still from Florida, you know what I mean? They weren't like those grandmas who's going to make you soup. They're the grandmas who like didn't quite finish up with spring break yet, you know? So like,
sounds like a retirement person in Germany also.
Like, yeah, see, the thing about getting older, which is why I try to keep myself active so that as I get older, I don't turn to someone who's bitter. You do tend to like, I don't know, there's a lot of studies that say getting older, you get happier, right? But I think that if you've had a happy life, that's how it goes. But if you have been bitter your whole life, then you move to Florida. So yeah, I'll take the Europeans on this one as well.
Oh, well, okay. Because I experience, coming from Barcelona, normally the old people, yes, there is certain things that they do, but in Germany, the complaining is next level. Like,
okay, but that's the thing about Germans. They do love a complaint.
Yes, but so when
they go
old...
You do everything bad you did in life, like, worse. Exactly. So they can be, that's a very extreme. But I'm also good at tuning them out. You know what I mean? Like, every time some German says something to me I don't like, I'm like, health insurance, health insurance, health insurance. And I snap my heels 3 times and it's all gone.
They can complain because they have pension. They have pension.
Yeah.
Well, when we arrive to pension, we will see if we will have that.
Like an American, I have some private investments going. I don't trust anyone with my pension.
Makes sense. So yeah, if that's okay for you, I would say that we jump directly into the second part of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
The expert doing comedy in Europe.
So, yeah, as I already mentioned in the introduction, you are one of these lucky stand-up comedians that actually are touring.
Yeah.
And they are not only doing open mics for 20 years. Mm-hmm. So you're living the dream, let's say, like this.
I mean, it's a choice, right? Because you have to push to do those things. And I started stand-up when I was 42, I want to say, or 43. Yeah, 42, 43, something like that. So I didn't feel like I had the time to dick around. So I had to like take my skill set and just exponentially make it go as fast as I possibly could. So I got as quickly from like open mic level to my own show level as I could possibly make myself do it.
How much time did?
I still think now is really when I've completely, like after at least 5 years is when you're like, oh yeah, I found my voice a bit. I know exactly what makes me different from maybe other comedians, or what's a joke that falls into my, you know, skill set or persona. I think that takes a really long time. So I would say a minimum, if you really want to do it, it takes a minimum of 5 years to kind of like know yourself, know your jokes. And it gets a lot easier to see the joke and things. You, I go back to old jokes and I'm like, why wouldn't I have seen this as backwards, right? Things like that. So the writing skills are now catching up to the performance skills, because I had performance skills from previous, from previous things. Experience. Exactly. And I had trained a comedy brain from mostly having a terrible childhood, because that's how you escape childhoods of my nature. So and then all the performance stuff. So yeah, that's about how long it took me.
Okay. I mean, it's not a lot to be like, you started late in this concept of like, and it's a cool thing that you are now having your own shows and doing your own stuff and happy doing that. And like, even starting late, it's not that you start late actually, because you were in stage all the rest of your life, but you were in different scenarios.
Exactly. I never stopped being on stage. I just changed what I was doing on stage. Yeah.
And this change, like, did it really happen? Like, in the sense of like, you were talking about like, okay, about pandemic comes and I started doing stand-up comedy because it also was easy to do solo things. It also probably affected the fact that doing improv classes was not a possibility anymore with the theater play and everything. Mm-hmm. So it was not really a conscious decision of like, I like these stand-up comedians so much that I'm pursuing doing something in that way.
I think it's a little combination of both. I've taken a lot of professional training in Chicago at the Second City. And so I did two intensive courses in stand-up comedy in Second City, and that helps you with like getting a baseline for like how to write a joke and how to recognize jokes and things like that. So that was kind of the starting place. And then I started dabbling, and I was still very much doing other things. But like I said, I just realized that if I really wanted to do stand-up, it was going to take everything to do it. You can't do it halfway, in my opinion. I mean, you can. You absolutely can if it's a pleasure for you to do it. But I just kind of knew that I wanted to do it to a certain level. And to do it to a certain level, it's going to take like intense focus and concentration, extreme self-criticism and self-awareness. You're going to have to be like, you know, hit the mic. You have to really be willing to criticize yourself, to take criticism, to fail so badly. But I feel like improv was great for that, because I had that mentality of every time I fail, I'm just getting further in what I really want to do. Mm. You know, and I feel like some people, if they don't have a performance or in particularly improv background, you come up to the stage and you bomb. I remember famously not doing that well at like a particular open mic. And Ava said to me, she was like, it was great because you just kept talking. And I was like, yeah, everyone wants to know what I have to say, don't they? So I didn't ever have this mentality like my failure was a terrible thing. I knew that it was not as good as it needed to be, but no one starts out in anything as good as they're going to get, right? So the exciting thing is drilling down and getting better and making improvements and developing. And I think that's what we want to do with our lives. So I found like this was really exciting in a way that other things weren't exciting to me. And it was special because what I love and dislike about improv is that it is an ensemble. So you're only playing to the level of the people around you, and you can't entirely control the situation. I love to control situations. So with stand-up, it's really your success or failure out there. You know what I mean? It's everything you did to get there and everything you didn't do. And that's it. There's no one else to blame. It's all on you.
But at the end, it shows also that you are able to handle the pressure of it, like, somehow. I remember he hasn't, like, I literally drop a mic and run through the door in the third open mic that we were there because I panic attack in the middle of the stage.
I cut that.
Yeah, I run away. So,
yeah.
I think there is stand-up comedians that are able to handle this pressure of, like, okay, it's not working too much, but I continue talking and something will pop up into that. And then there is other people like me that if we blog and we have something very structured that we wanted to do and it's not really working, then mm-hmm. you are not able to. And this comes with experience, probably.
It comes with experience, but I also think improv is so great for that. So I recommend improv for basically everyone to have some life skills. But, like, you learn that that moment that things didn't go to plan is just an opportunity to shift. Now, I will say, like, marrying my improv brain to my stand-up brain is also only coming now-ish. It's very hard to have both those skill sets going at the same time where you're extremely loose and flowy and also extremely structured. That is super hard. So I still feel like that's the goal every time I go out, but it doesn't always happen. But I think that it's like anything, it's experience. You panic the third time, but by the 10th time or 15th time, you won't panic anymore because it's, like, you know, par for the course. That's how it goes. It's fine.
So at the end, it's for you, it's this combination of, like, you really prepare your stand-up, the shows, of course, but even the open mics, you structure them?
Yeah, yeah. There are 1,000 note cards in my house everywhere. I have, I have a process where I keep notes in Evernote, and then I put them on cards, and then I transfer the cards into a script for a piece, you know, and then I try to use, like, I use titles to make sure that I have, like, my set list. So I'm very, very structured in how I approach everything. It doesn't work for everybody. A lot of stand-ups have the luxury. I can't go out every night. You know, I don't have the ability to go out on stage every night. So I work a lot at home to create what I want so that when I go out on stage, it's what I want to say because, you know.
So at the end, you have, like, your work. I wanted to ask about the process itself because you're right, like, what it could be a joke or a punch and whatever. And that you try to fit it in some kind of blog afterwards.
So
category or
my actual process would be like I have a thought that's kind of funny, right? Like my thought on my way here was somebody stopped for me to cross the street, and that wouldn't happen in Frankfurt. If I was illegally trying to cross the street, I would get honked at and they would hate me. And so I thought to myself, oh, I kind of like the sexism here. It's nice. Now, it might not have been sexism. It could have just been that's how things go here. But I thought that's a funny joke.
No, you were really lucky that they don't run over you, actually. Like,
there you go. Lucky I didn't die. But I assumed in my little brain that perhaps it was because I was a lady wearing pink and the nice gentleman decided to let me go. Now, that's a thought I had. What I'll do is I'll write that thought down. I'll tag it with something like, I don't know, sexism or lady joke or something that I've got
so
a category. Yeah, I have categories. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then later I go back and I look through those and I write those down on cards. And then I start flipping through the cards and being like, is this complete? Is it done yet? Is it just an idea? And then I start putting it into a script if it's going to go into like my show. Wow. Yeah. So I have big themes. I tend to talk about the same things over and over again, like how I moved to Germany or how I come from Florida or American stuff. You know, there are certain things about you that are just fundamental to who you are as a person that you're going to hit on. My bad childhood. You're going to hit on over and over and over again. But you're going to find new ways, hopefully, to like unpack them and explore them. And then, new punchline. So it rarely starts with a punchline. It almost always starts with a premise. Mm-hmm. People aren't always so good at separating the two. So it starts with a premise, which is just like an idea. And so like if I said I'm really enjoying the sexism here, I'd have to have a lot of punchlines to make that work as a comedy, you know, routine. It's not just like people just go out on stage with a kind of a naked idea and wait for the laughs to come. And that's why they don't, because you haven't actually dug in. So I also find that it's not like an immediate process. Sometimes I immediately think of a one-liner or a good joke, but usually it's like this long process of like a thought here on the train at 2:00 on a Tuesday, and then a year later, it's a fully realized part of a whole piece. Yeah.
Makes sense. I mean, it's very similar how I used to write, actually. Like I have a topic, I use Notion and I have my structured like topics, tags, comedy, and then from that I transform it into a script. I don't flip cards, but I flip notes in the computer, this, and then I say, okay, from that block I have enough to try to connect it to the other one, and how I connect that block to the other and make it work in a whole script for a show, a potential show. At the end, I was even preparing, like, if I had 3 minutes, I prepared 3 minutes. That's it.
Yeah, yeah.
To that point, like, even preparing the open mics as if they were proper shows.
Right.
because I think I was more in the structured way of doing that. I know a lot of comedians that just jump in stage.
Yeah.
And this happens to me like 5 minutes ago and they are able to structure it into it. And I'm just like,
can they get it back though? You know what I mean? Like, so if I could do that on like an improvised mic or I just kind of like throw something out there and it's really fun. I mean, maybe, but then will I remember it? Will it be as funny the next time? You know? So it's all about how your process works. There's nothing wrong with being the other way. It's just, I'm also a theater kid. So that's why people are surprised maybe that I'm already on my second show and I haven't got ideas for my third one. And I'm like, yeah, but you see, I think in pieces, I think motif, theme, beginning, middle, and end. So it's like my last show definitely had a narrative, a story, but this show doesn't, but it still has like, it's like a full, it's a full piece. Things should tie together and I can do chunks of it and it's great. You know, I don't have to do the whole thing, but I'm interested in building a whole thing. That's the creative part of my brain wants to make a thing.
Which brings to the fact that you generally, like in an open mic, you can throw something like, I don't know, this happened here when I was in Greece and therefore I have an open mic and I can throw a trial joke, no? Because at the end, open mics are for that. But this weekend, for example, that you have a show, even if this joke happened here and it will enter because probably there is Greek audience in here, you will not try it because your show is closed 100%.
How do you mean?
So for example, the joke that you just said here,
the sexism joke.
I suppose that the Greeks will relate with
it. I might use that. I haven't decided. Yeah. Okay. If I can develop a little more,
But are you able, like from a process perspective, even with shows like that normally are a little bit more close, you have your like thing that you repeat and to introduce things around it?
Yeah, I mean, like I was in Bucharest a couple of weeks ago and I wrote at least like 3 or 4 jokes while I was there. Kind of like, again, opening one-liner type thing so that the audience like says like, oh, she sees me, that I'm here. Because I think that's the thing about me. I like, thank you for the podcast, but I'm not like a medium person. I'm a live stage person. I like to be on stage. I like to be in a room with people. So if you are going into a room with only the things you have in your head and you don't want to recognize these humans, these Greek people, these people from Bucharest, then you're probably not doing them or you any favors. So you really have to be sensitive to like, bringing this room your jokes and adapting them so that that room can get there with you. Mm-hmm. You know, that's your whole job is to get them to, you know, sort of see you and recognize you. And when you go, I see you, I recognize you, then they
you get points whenever you want in top of you.
Exactly. So,
actually, talking about rooms, that's very interesting. Like now that you're touring around Europe, maybe I think as far as I saw.
At the moment, yeah.
How did you notice very, very difference between audiences? Like, because I know when I used to do a little bit of stand-up in Barcelona, people react, probably they are drunk, compared to the Germans, that they stand a little bit more serious or whatever. Like, do you really realize this while doing this?
I think, for sure, there's differences. But, I mean, if you're really good and you're doing what I said, the idea of like, you know, this is not say I'm really good. It's just, if you are really good, and you are good at getting in a room with anybody, I don't think there's any audience that isn't capable of laughing with you. That's one thing when things go wrong and people are like, it wasn't a good audience. You're like, nah, there were people who they paid money to come laugh. So they're probably okay. You know what I mean?
They paid to come to their show.
Exactly. Not like... That's already a good start. You know, now have I had audiences that were genuinely too drunk? Yes. And that's not a good audience. I will agree there. So there are better and worse audiences. Germans do tend to be very like proud of you as opposed to like laughing out loud at you the way Americans or Britons might. They're like, look at you up there. They're so intrigued.
Your tone was so good.
It's a little, the German word Zurückhaltung, that's a little, you know, it's downplayed, but it's still there and you can feel their appreciation. And in a way, I think they've been good for me because I don't have huge expectations for mega watt laughter. So when you get it, you're like, oh, I'm somewhere where they laugh out loud. This is delightful. So yeah, I think audiences are definitely different. When we went to Bucharest, I really thought that they would let the audience know that we were not, you know, Romanian speaking before we walked out. But in fact, they were just like, here's the mic, go on out there. And so we had to, you know, go up, take a microphone with a crowd that expected Romanian words to come out to this Romanian audience. And it was all in English. So I was like, surprise, you know, and that was really funny. But then they were, you know, Romanian people, not unlike young Greeks. I mean, people speak English. So it's not just about the language. They know the words, right? But you have to get them on board with your shtick. And that can, you know, that's a whole other thing. So, yeah, but they were very kind and warm and generous and they laughed. You know, they were like a little confused at first. But once they got past that, they were very happy to laugh.
Yeah, I did a couple of open mics here also in Greek.
In Greek, like everyone in Greek but me in English. And it was also a fun experience. Also, this extra laugh of people who are not clearly, they, you look at them and they are not understanding a shit of what you're saying.
Okay, that's different. When they and really don't understand.
The person next to them is laughing. They need to, like, social pressure of laughing also. And that fills the room. It's incredible. Like,
yeah.
I was, okay, why is this working with this person who clearly is not understanding anything what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's funny. Going to that, like, you analyze, I suppose, like, how the performance has gone in that sense. So you record yourself.
Oh yeah,
you...
always. I think it's foolhardy not to record yourself every single time. First of all, because I live in fear of saying the funniest thing I've ever said and not remembering it. It's, my brain is you know, hitting the menopause mush moments. So I want to protect my jokes and thoughts. But secondly, because, and I don't usually watch it right away, although sometimes I'm excited to see how it went, but usually I wait a while after a performance and then I go back and try to more clinically study it and go like, okay, you thought that you were going to get a laugh here and you got a sticker if at best. So clearly you could work on that joke, make it stronger, put it somewhere else.
So at the end you mark your own script saying, okay, this part worked, this part not, or?
I mean, I can get that intense about it, but it's more like just really sitting there and watching it a few times and learning from it. And then usually, yeah, making a few quick adjustments.
Cool. Do you watch stand-up comedy girls?
Yeah, I mean, I do. But I have to say, the longer you do it, the harder it is to watch. First, so when I watch like Netflix specials of comedians I like, I mean, I don't know if I ever sat around and laughed out loud by myself, because I think that's what's special about being in a room, is that the way we all egg each other on to laugh. So the laughter is louder and it's a real experience. When you're sitting at home with Netflix, even if it's your favorite comedian, it's very hard to be like, ha, 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 ha. I mean, it happens, but it's rare. So I can watch a really great special and I'm just studying it. I'm not like, I'm just quietly watching it and going like, oh, that, I see why that worked. That's a good idea. You know, stuff like that. So and then when you come to open mics and you've been to a lot of them, it can be hard, to watch, you know, a lot of open mics. So I would absolutely, like, I saw Daniel Sloss last year. I mean, any professional comedian whom I like and respect, I would love to see them live.
Right.
And I will watch them on Netflix. But I will not enjoy them as much. Unless
even live?
Live, yeah, absolutely. I think live is the whole thing, right? Because being in a room with people and their personality and them responding to you, it's what gives you that feeling. It's like, you know, you love a band and then you go to their concert. You know, I don't really listen to music, but I assume that's why people go to concerts. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
For that experience to see your group is a completely different thing than listening to the radio or the album, which is still enjoyable.
But it's a different vibe.
It's a different vibe, yeah.
Oh, that's very interesting. Like, I think there is the analytical part, no? When you're dedicating yourself to that at the end, when you're watching someone else doing exactly the same thing that you're doing.
True.
You tend to go to this kind of like more analytical of like, I can use that. I can whatever. No, it's...
You're learning.
End,
you're
it's
studying.
It's
yeah.
a profession somehow, and it's the dedication of your life. So that's how it's transformed from being a hobby to a professional thing, probably.
It's also tough because I think you do compare yourself and that comparison is necessary, but I don't necessarily mean professionals. It's very easy to compare yourself to professionals and be like, I'm not as good at them. What can I learn? When you compare yourself to people on kind of your level, it feels a bit mean, but you have to do it. You have to be like, you know, what is this person doing better than me? What could I be doing better? You have to be constantly willing to take that feedback on board or you're not going to get better.
Yeah. What about improv?
What about it? I still love it.
Do you ever go to watch improv? Or?
I ever go watch improv. I found it harder. I was bad improv's really bad.
Bad comedy, just bad open mics are
bad
really
open mics
bad.
There's something still kind of exciting about watching.
Yeah, because
person.
You can get drunk, but besides that,
maybe you get drunk at improv. I don't know. There's something about like watching improv go down in flames that you're like, nah, you feel bad for people versus where stand up. You're like, hey, you planned this. This is your whole thing. You thought this was going to be great. It's easier. I don't know. But like with improvisers, it's such a soft, gentle, sweet art form. I don't really enjoy it if it's not people who are pretty experienced or pretty good, you know, or well connected. Because I think that's what makes improv exciting is when you're watching a group of people who rehearse like crazy
really, yeah.
And they're like, you know, locked in together and they the magic comes from how did they know that was going to come next, you know, but they've just been with each other for so long that
together for so long that they know what it will come next. They know how the other person thinks, what they know, the flaws and everything.
It's
magic when the group connects pretty well.
It's
the whole key of
it. I agree.
Now you were talking about like bad stand up in the sense of like sometimes bad improv happens. It happens, sure. You fail. It's part of the process at the end.
Totally.
How do you handle failure in that sense?
As I said, I think you just see every time, you know, improv that fails. So you asked me if I enjoy watching it. I think it's different because I've just seen a lot of it. Mm. If it's a group of people I care about, I almost enjoy it more if they fail. I don't know. Like, it's not a problem for me. I'm entertained. You can still sit in the room and be like, good job. You know what I mean? But what was the question?
How do you handle failure yourself?
How do I handle like failure myself? Like a decade and a half worth of improv lessons are deep set in my mind that every time I fail at something, I've ticked closer to doing better the next time. So I don't like it. You know, like it's not fun for me if I go out and I try to do 10 minutes of stand up and it didn't go well.
You don't block yourself in the sense of like I'm not doing stand up for the next month.
No, I would. I mean, like I think I'm also a tenacious person, which you have to be. I really don't like to give up. You know, so I won't let it get me. You know what I mean? Like you can't get me. I'll get you. So I have a pretty strong work ethic, and I just work harder, and then usually that is enough. Because people can't expect to not put in the work. You have to put in the work for great improv too. You have to put in the work. It's a different kind of work. You have to rely on other people to do the work, but you still have to do the work. And so I'm usually just like, well, I guess I need to do more work, you know? But what are we here for? Like, on Earth, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
To get better at something, right? To care about something. So this is what I care about.
That's true. I found something that it's a little bit like recurrent, that it happened in open lights, and these people that tries the same joke recurrently and get trapped in this kind of thing, like they internally think that this is a very, very good joke, and we see them failing recurrently with the same joke thousands of times because of the concept of like the audience is different, maybe this time enters.
Okay.
Have you had this situation ever? Like,
where I tried a joke that just didn't work.
You are convinced that this joke is good, but at the end it never feeds into it. What do you do with these jokes at the end? Or these punchlines?
I mean, I think good jokes and bad jokes, again, I have a tendency to think in a piece. Sometimes there's a place where I'm expecting more laughter and I get more of a, you know? But I don't always think that's bad, because as long as I'm making people think, you know, it's okay. But when people are thinking, they can't be laughing. So you don't want to over be thinking. They've come to a comedy show. So if it's a moment of quietude for the sake of I've said something interesting and not really, really funny, I'm pretty comfortable with that.
Okay.
But in terms of seeing somebody just like, you know, try and try and try with a joke and not really get it there, you know, I tend to think that person's either, you know, it's like an improv. You have to be listening to the audience, listening to yourself. You know, if you're not trying to evaluate what you're doing up there afterwards, then it's probably not going to go great for you. Even if you have some good jokes, the whole experience isn't going to work unless you're really willing to be like, it is good, but I could make it better, right? Like, you just have to constantly, so if you have good jokes that are working, you got to keep making them better. You even got to cut those good jokes and make new good jokes. Like, it's just like a constant regrowth. And some people have resilience for that. And other people would like to get a little bit of attention. They've got some jokes that work. Mm-hmm. They're happy with that. They go out there, they tell those jokes. And that's it for them. You know, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that either. It's not what I'm doing, hopefully. but I think everybody, as I said, creativity belongs to everybody. Mm-hmm. And whatever part of it you choose to get on board with, I'm fine with that. You know what I mean? I might not want to listen to that same 5 minutes of jokes over and over again, but God bless.
Yeah. Talking about God blessed, I was going to ask you, God bless America or God bless you know, Europe in sense of comedians, because I think there is a very clear line of difference between stand-up on a way of doing it in America versus the European way of doing it.
Yeah, and even there, I mean, is there a European way? I mean, I would
European way. It's not a European way, because a British comedian doesn't do anything in the same way as a Spanish comedian.
Correct.
But
Yeah, I think, for example, there is a more distinct style in improv. So Europeans have long form improv tends to be narratives, so the story. American improv tends to be a deconstruction, so premise based jokey. Yeah. And then, you know, short form is kind of the same everywhere. With stand up, I think that the art form feels like it kind of originated there a little bit in America. And the network is really strong for doing it. It's not necessarily always healthy because there's a lot of issues in and around, especially around gender roles and women getting places and all that kind of stuff. So I wouldn't say like that's a scene I'm desperate to be part of. But in terms of cranking out a lot of really amazing, talented performers who've been able to go down the path and learn that, yeah, I mean, America definitely has more, you know, and it's a huge country, 335 million people, 50 states, you know, so all one language, right? Yeah. Even though they have different cultures in those 50 states, they have one language at least that kind of unites them together, one nationality. So they're all on the same page. So like you said, if you go to Barcelona, you're going to hear very different jokes, both in Spanish than in English. If you go to the UK, even if you're from parts of the UK, it's very different. So if we're just talking like English country to English country. So yeah, it's more uniform in a sense, and it has a lot of opportunities and everybody kind of knows what it is. There's talk of like there was a heyday with stand-up, and I think it's gone down a lot from its heyday in the, let's say, 80s. But in a way that's good because that heyday was also probably not healthy. It was like a bit of a bubble, you know? So now what's left is like plenty of clubs and places and open mics and people such that, and this is something I really like about stand-up too. There's no gatekeeper in a way. You just can be like, I'm going to do it. You know, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to do it. And no one can stop you. You know what I mean? You can sign up for an open mic.
No, that's what open mics are about at the end.
Right? Absolutely. Like, but if you're doing a play, the director has to pick you. If you're in an improv group, the coach has to put you on the team, right? So somebody has to say yes to you. It's also what I don't like about stand-up is because a lot of people maybe shouldn't be doing stand-up, you know, and there's no one to stop them.
Yeah.
But I think it's beautiful in the sense of the egalitarianism that anybody can kind of be like, this is what I want to do, and they do it.
But at the end, it's where it makes the cut, no? Probably the difference between the people who spends all their stand-up career in open mics, it's probably because they are not refining their jokes until a point of being able to do a show out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this threshold always in stand-up comedy, which is like, it's clear, I think, for me, like, difference between doing open mics regularly, even if whatever, and never arriving to a show. That's when it changes the whole scene. Like, if you're arriving to have your own shows, and because that you need to sell. It's not anymore you're writing down a name in an email and saying, I'm going to this open mic.
Exactly. Yeah,
it's like putting the effort of like, hey, I have this show, I'm doing that. Especially going touring, it's even more complex probably.
Yeah.
But you need to show yourself and sell that show to people. That's
and
where
be confident
takes.
That you have a product. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, open mics should be, for all comedians, a tool to get to the next step. And there are a lot of people, as you kind of mentioned, that like want to stay on that lower level because they enjoy the open mic scene. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know what I mean?
Maybe it's more a hobby, like I used to do. Like
at the end,
for me, it wasn't going to be any career or professional thing because it was just for me a way of like, oh, okay, I have these punchlines, I have these jokes, I structure it a little bit, and I go to an open mic because I had material, but I am not going to spend my life. I have a job. I have the other things to do, unfortunately, that fits my schedule too much to be able to dedicate myself into the show. And maybe I don't want to throw myself into there also. Because it's not an easy life, I assume.
No.
I think now it's growing a little bit more, the idea that also like jam sessions can arrive to, for example, something like theater. Here in Athens, there is a group actually that it's doing improv jam.
It's
kind of cool. But it's true that stand-up is very entry-level like thing. You can enter through there very easily.
Yeah.
Finding the correct people inside of comedy, it's difficult, I assume.
Very hard, yeah.
Toxic? You have some,
yeah, it's super toxic. I didn't want to bring it up, but you said it. I mean, that was another thing when I first got into stand-up that it repelled me from stand-up, and then it made me work even harder because there were a lot of mean boys, that's what I'll call them, and it's not to put it all on boys, but these people were mean and they were boys, so they were mean boys and they didn't particularly care for me coming in, and sort of it felt like ruining their fun. Like they had established what they wanted to do, and I didn't always laugh at their jokes because I didn't find them funny or frankly appropriate, but that's not the point. I just wasn't going to give them the gift of laughter if it wasn't genuine. If you want to go up and do inappropriate jokes, I guess that's up to you. I'm going to do what I care about and you do you, but they hated me for like not getting on board with their thoughts and ideas. So yeah, that was really hard, because here I was finally saying like, you know, I kind of wanted to do this my whole life, and I think I'm kind of a naturally funny person, but it takes so much, like, it takes everything you have to do a good job. So I needed people to be supportive and be like, yeah, come on, girl, you got this, you know? And it took like a couple of years of meeting Ava, finding other people who we were like, we just want to build each other up. You know what I mean? Like, that's what you should get from your colleagues. That's what I had at improv, was people who loved each other and wanted to build each other up and were like all about encouraging each other. And I still enjoy so much experience from my like love for my improv community. So it was hard for me to accept this lone wolf, fuck you, I'm a comedian, get out of here kind of thing.
I think people, and
I'm correcting you, it's not like this, but I always have the feeling that stand up in that sense, as you're doing it alone,
yeah,
in there, people misunderstand that as a concept that you arrive there alone, which is not true at all.
No.
It's like, jokes are refined through having someone who's listening to that, giving you feedback. And normally who is giving you feedback is not the audience. It's the other comedians who are in the stand-up.
It can be,
it can be the audience. But it can go the complete way around, as you are saying. Like, if the people who is around you doing comedy, it's not supportive, maybe they don't give you this gig. Maybe they don't give you the option of like, okay, I'm doing this show, maybe you can do the opener of it. The opening or this kind of thing is when it starts flourishing.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt like that in the United States, this kind of circle, it's very men's.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the comedians that are there, women, are making jokes that are also fitting into this
male world. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
On the opposite, in Europe, there is no circle at all. I don't know.
It's not coordinated. But I have to say, I was in Chicago for a month doing comedy 2 summers ago. And I think that was a really great, it's a great city. I love Chicago. And it just, there was a lot of everything. I got some great shows from the broiest of bros who were so sweet and sugary and supportive as well. So again, not to put it on men or women, but like you have kind of, In stand-up, you have people who are also like very lone wolfy, and you have people who want to be part of a community.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you're dealing with someone of any gender who's got your back, I think, pretty quick, who wants you to be good so that they can be good, so we can all be good together. It's pretty fast for me. And there are, you know, it's just a question of size. Again, Chicago is a comedy city where you can go to, I did often 3 to 4 mics a night. You know, you can test jokes ad nauseum. You know, you have lots of opportunity, and where you have opportunity, you have every kind of person. Where you have a very closed situation and only 1 or 2 people are running the whole scene, what made those people want to run a comedy scene? You know what I mean? Like,
being there, probably, and I don't know. Like,
everyone has their motivation.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And in English. In Europe, you add the extra part of language.
Mm-hmm.
In a city like Athens, right now there is 2 open mics, for example, running very, very regularly in English.
Mm-hmm.
It's 2 open mics.
Yeah, exactly.
But they intercalate things, and they happen whenever they happen, and it's really like the art where you're going to do the show this weekend, which is more like a month-based thing, which is, makes it really difficult to be consistent in here.
Sure.
And then the other one, which is normally done in a Metatsukiyo, Exodus Cafe Neo. And that one generically happened to be because a comedian who is wanted to have it more regularly start doing it. But if he's not in the city, this doesn't happen.
Exactly.
And it's very difficult to be consistent. If you don't build your own thing in cities where the language is not, if you would be doing stand-up comedy in Greek, there is nearly every night, weekly.
Exactly, yeah.
And that makes things very, very difficult.
100%. So the organizers either have to be coming from a place of total passion themselves and really want to make a stand-up scene happen and really want to be usually stand-ups themselves, or, I don't know, something else. So that's the best case scenario. And then there's not that many people out there, because what people terribly underestimate is the work, you know, not just the work of writing jokes. That part is already a lot. And then you have the work of organizing and getting people to come on your show and things like that. You know, we run the weekly open mic in Frankfurt. Ava really works hard on it. I support her more than anything these days. But it's it's so much work and people really underestimate that. And one thing that's good is once you've kind of got it established, it becomes less work. So once you've got it going and it's got a system, that's pretty good. But it's just a lot, and people aren't always appreciative. You know what I mean? Not the audience members, not the comedians. I mean, usually yes, 80% yes. But when you have kind of a couple of people coming in and ruining the fun, you're like, I just wanted to do comedy. This is a lot of extra work, and now you're being a jerk to me, right? You know, so it's like, it's a whole lot of factors that sometimes people don't think about. So, you know, sometimes people don't get slots because you just don't have any, you know? And sometimes people really misbehave, and they should be aware of the fact that, hi, this is a lot of work for the people who are organizing.
And in the end, they are organizing it for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a service. When you do an open mic, you are providing a service for comedians to practice. And you are also appreciating the fact that they are being part of your show, you know, so they're doing something in return for you. It's not a completely one way, but you have to see it as a two-way street.
Yeah.
And, you know, if the organizers need your help with something, then you should probably be like, sure, you know what I mean? Yeah, I'd be happy to help.
Cool. I think... close a little bit the episode if you want.
Yeah.
You are having a show this Saturday.
Sunday.
Yeah. Sorry. In here in Athens, but you are having other dates already. You were saying.
So I think my next big one is going to be in Brighton in May.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm doing the Brighton Fringe Festival. So 4 performances in my next solo show, which is called Miscommunication, and. That's really like for me the kind of the beginning of the journey. We already done a couple previews, but that's really the beginning of the journey for that show. Mm-hmm. Is it's going to start there, Miscommunication, and then I'm going to start looking. I've got a couple things going. I've got one show happening in Hamburg. I'm doing Barcelona, so I'm looking now at other cities I'd like to go to in Europe for the summer and really kick that show off. So I hope to live with that show for a while because my old show, Involuntary Manslaughter, had a lot of, as well, like pictures and things. It was, it had storytelling and theatrical elements. So this one's just stand up, you know, it's just me and a mic.
Okay.
And yeah, so it'll grow and change a lot.
Nice. So it's more like what you're planning to do for the next month is this.
Yeah, for a hot second, I'm going to really stick with this and really work it out and see what works, what's exciting.
So that's good. Yeah. So I think. All the audience should check your Instagram. It's Abby for Love.
Pretty much everywhere you have a social media handle. Mine is Abby, ABBY, for the number laughs.
Okay. And I think you have a website.
I do have a website. That's easier. AbigailPaul.com. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it will be all in the description of the episode, of course. So you can stay tuned and see if Abby's coming to your city, then go for the show and meet her. And maybe just after the show, say something.
Yes.
As a podcast listener, I came because of that.
Do that.
That would be great.
I would be very excited about that. The way I was so excited when we knew each other and here we are in Athens.
Because when this happens, hopefully I bring some audience.
The randomness of life is so beautiful.
So thank you so much
for
accepting this invitation and for bringing your experience in comedy and theater in general. Like it has been a really, really good pleasure to have you here. Besides that, of course, thanks to Banca Cafe to let us this cool space to record today.
Very good coffee.
Very good coffee. So if you are around Exarchia, just grab a coffee here because it's worth it. And of course, infinite thanks to every listener who is around there. Don't forget to subscribe and follow to see this episode and the next episodes that are coming. Again, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark.
This is Expat Experts. Support this podcast by listening us in Podomo and subscribe in Spotify and YouTube.